everybody. It's Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. Bringing you ideas, concepts, a guest or two to help you lead a more positively minded life. New ideas. New ideas. Oh, we have such new ideas around here. Today we have such a unique idea for you. Today we have a guest who's got lessons to teach. Diana Winston is one of the world's leading authorities on Buddhism. Actually, she might say she's one of the world's leading authorities on nothing and nothingness. It's cute. Anyway, what does it make it? What does that all mean? You know, what does it mean? Do you think you're going to have another lesson on Buddhism? Do you think we're going to bring you another thing on how to relax, how to close your eyes, how to breathe deep, how to take it easy? No, that's not what today's about. Today's about the path. Taking the path. And I think you're going to find a great deal of this very interesting. So here we go, Diana Winston, because part of what we're going to teach you today is we're going to teach you about the path, about what happens when you make a decision for yourself to go somewhere and what you've got to deal with. Now, Diana Winston is such a brave human being. Mind you, young woman decides she's going to go to Burma, of all places, to become a Buddhist nun. Now, being a Buddhist nun is no easy trick. Being a Buddhist nun means the serious kind of Buddhism stuff. Stuff that doesn't even exist, because most Buddhists we know are men, right? The real Buddhists. And the ones that we see around here, the ones we've had on the air, mostly men. Mostly men wearing robes. The monks are, of course, men. That's what I thought. Well, until I learned about what Diana had done and the path she had taken, and I think we can learn a great deal from it. And we could also get a special insight into the world of Buddhism on the inside. You know, so, Diana, welcome to WBAI.
Hi, Armand. It's good to be here.
Yeah, nice to have you here. This is a thing that you decided to do, right? You decided to become a Buddhist and to really study it the hard way. Why?
Well, it wasn't exactly a decision. It was more like it sort of evolved. I, very early on in my early 20s, got interested in Tibetan politics and then found myself hearing Buddhist teachings, and something really clicked for me. And I was quite young. And slowly I realized I needed to learn meditation, and I began to sit meditation retreats and more meditation retreats, and soon I was sitting for 3 months at a time and did this over a number of years. And then ultimately I decided I need to go into something heavier or a little more immersion, and that's when I made a decision to go to Burma.
So you go to Burma, mm-hmm. right? You go there as a tourist, I guess.
Actually, no, you don't go there as a tourist. I got what's called a meditation visa, a religious visa, because the tourist visa gives money to the Burmese government, which we don't want to do. The religious visa is a whole separate way of entering the country. It was actually a hard decision about going to the country. I had very strong spiritual longings to be there because one of my teachers taught there, and he's probably one of the leading meditation masters in the world. And yet it was in this country where I was very strongly opposed to the political situation and wondered if my presence there would add legitimacy to this military regime. I don't know if it did.
Okay, now you get there.
Yeah.
Right? And you say, okay, I want to be a Buddhist nun, but I thought there were no Buddhist nuns.
Okay, technically there's no Buddhist nuns.
Which is perfect for a Buddhist, you know, then you become nothing.
I was definitely nothing. In fact, just to say, I'm not the world-renowned expert. I was just a Buddhist nun.
Okay.
The Buddhist order, the order of nuns, died out several thousand years ago. And in its place that when women make a decision that they want to, quote, enter the holy life, as it's called, they become what's called 10 precept nuns. And so technically in the culture, it's not looked on as being a real nun in the way that the monks are looked on. But yet these women are practicing very devotedly. And
So what happens to you? I mean, let's talk about the 10 precepts. These are the 10 rules of being a nun.
Yeah.
Right?
You, to ordain as a nun, and let me say that it's a temporary ordination if you wish. I mean, I could do it for life, but it's kind of neat. It's set up in Burma that if you ordain just even for 5 minutes, it's considered very meritorious. Whereas in some cultures, like in Tibetan Buddhism, they want you to ordain for life, and it's actually a big infraction if you disrobe, if you stop being a nun or a monk. Whereas in Theravadan Buddhism, the Buddhism I practice, it's if you stop being a nun, it doesn't matter because you've just spent the past week being one, and that's really great. So what I did was I ordained for a year, and that meant shaving my head, and which was quite an interesting experience.
Yeah, what was that like? I mean, you know.
You've got
a pretty head of hair now. I mean, you just lost it, right? Did you take it right off?
Well, I was slowly in the year leading up to it cutting it shorter and shorter. And mm-hmm. then when I got there and I chose to ordain, off it all came. It was kind of intense because there's so much associated with our hair, with sexuality and attraction and the way we interact with people. And so to lose it, it felt very naked and yet very freeing. It was quite beautiful. Actually.
Freeing in what way?
Well, just like the rest of the nun's rules, it takes you out of the realm of sexuality. The number one nun's rule there is celibacy. And so it's like you stop being a sexual being in some ways for that period of time. Do you want me to say the other rules? Or?
Well, you know, of course, we're talking about sex, which is always one of the most exciting topics here on WBAI. Just for a quick minute, All right? A lot of people, I could imagine, who feel like a failure in life, failure in relationships, failure in dealing with their anger, failure in being emotionally, they could jump in and say, well, I'll give up something. But, you know, you can't give up anything you never had a right to. You were, by the time you went to become a Buddhist nun, right, you were not running away from sexuality, and you know that because you had had a number of experiences in your life. You weren't somebody who was traumatized by sex and said, therefore, I'm going to become a nun. Is that true?
Absolutely.
So you actually enjoyed yourself sexually, physically, emotionally
of
with
course,
people.
Of course.
And you enjoyed relationships.
Uh-huh.
And yet they say you got to become celibate, right?
Yes.
And you say, okay, I'm going to become celibate, which includes, I'm going to, well, you say include shaving your head, but those are two different things, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
It's just you're not supposed to attract. They figure if you're Sinead O'Connor, you're not going to look attractive to anybody. What is the idea of it?
Well, I think part of it, it's just the tradition that shaving one's head is what Buddhist monks and nuns have done for 2,500 years. I was definitely not someone who was traumatized by sexuality. I didn't see this as running away from anything at all. I saw this as an opportunity to sort of put sexuality aside, essentially, for a time being. I think I, like most people, spend a lot of my time thinking about sexuality, acting on it. There's a lot of harmfulness that happens. There's a lot of great stuff that happens. I mean, I don't have any problem with it. Such as what?
I mean, when you get to look at it, and once you remove it, mm-hmm. I guess you could see what it is. Because when we were speaking with Nicholas Vreeland, mm-hmm. who's, I think, a Tibetan Buddhist, and he was talking about sexuality. He was talking about how involved it is, how involved he being a celibate. He said how involved our world is in our sexuality. There is such an important thing to it. So what do you see once you really give it up, you know? What happens? I mean, what do you begin seeing? How much of your time do you think is involved in one way or another with your sexuality?
I think this is a great question, and it's sort of the underlying basis of why one would go into a monastery and renounce sexuality, among other things. I mean, it's not only sexuality that I was renouncing. I was renouncing relationships, my family, my friends. I was renouncing speech. I was silent for a year in the monastery.
Silent for a year?
Yeah, I was silent for a year.
Let me think about what that's like for 2 minutes. A year? A year of silence? Actually, I have a good friend who's in Italy who does silent retreats. And I've been a part of that. And that's really been kind of amazing to be part of a silent retreat. You really begin hearing differently, too. But silent for a year. So during that whole time, you now have your head shaved, right? What are the other rules?
Okay, we're not allowed to eat after 12 noon. So we have two meals a day, one at 5 o'clock in the morning and one at 10:30 in the morning. And then the rest of the day, you're allowed to drink juice with no pulp. But that's it. And other rules, no.
Why?
Why? It was what was developed thousands of years ago. And I think it was because the Buddhist monks live lived with lay people. You know, they would wander around as mendicants and they would depend upon the alms of lay people. And I think in order to minimize their impact, their rule developed that they should only have one meal a day.
So a lot of these rules developed out of necessity.
Definitely.
Not only just out of austerity, right?
Definitely, yes. Uh-huh.
Okay, keep going. So what else for the woman?
So we're also no killing, no stealing, no lying, no intoxicants, and no adorning the body in any way, and no sleeping in high and luxurious beds, which actually wasn't a problem because they gave us a mat, just a straw mat to sleep on. So it wasn't an issue.
That must have been interesting for a young Jewish woman coming from Connecticut, huh?
It was definitely a change, to say the least. It was hard. I mean, it was a very difficult situation. I had sort of built it up in my head around a lot of expectations that going to Burma would be the best conditions to practice in because this is the place that the Dharma, the teachings of the Buddha, originated from. And so I don't know where these ideas came from, but when I got there, the conditions were really hard. It was very hot. I mean, it was over 100 degrees nearly all the time.
And it's moist heat, isn't it?
Oh,
it's
moist heat. I mean, it was essentially like meditating in a sauna most of the day.
Wearing these robes, how many layers of robes do you have to wear? If they're going to desexualize you, they're probably going to make sure nobody could see.
Exactly.
Exactly. So what were
exactly.
You wearing?
I had four layers of robes. So I had like an undershirt and then a longer shirt and then a one layer and then another layer and then a scarf over it. They didn't want to make sure you had no body parts, essentially.
Nothing showing.
Nothing
huh?
showing.
How long is this? Down to the
down,
ankle?
Yeah, to the ankle, up to the to the neck.
Are your arms allowed to show?
No. We had right down to the wrists was the outfit. Yeah,
only your hands showing. Your face is allowed to show.
And your bald scalp is allowed to show.
And your scalp is allowed to show.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's it. So you're exposed that way. So I guess, you know, it's kind of interesting because you are aerating it. The bald scalp helps you. I guess it helps you drop the temperature a little bit, doesn't it?
Definitely, definitely.
And now, outside of these rules, are there little variations? Like, can you wear a hat?
When it gets cool, which is in the winter for about a month, we could wear a hat, but we couldn't wear it in formal situations, like when we're going to teachings or when we're eating like that.
And is this quiet the whole time?
Yeah, I mean, the monastery isn't...
How do you say pass the salt?
You point.
Okay, so you learn how to point.
Yeah, I mean, the monastery itself isn't quiet. The monastery has a lot of activity going on because it's very integrated. It's a lot like churches here. You know, people are coming in and they're interacting and getting teachings from the monks who are living there. Of course, it's all monk teachers who are men. It's not women, nuns. The women are mostly... There's a lot of women practicing there. I wanted to distinguish. There's the life of the monastery going on, and then there are all these meditators, which is what I chose to do. I came. Some monks and nuns study and sort of work and spend time at the monastery. Whereas I was just a meditator there, which meant that was why I didn't talk the whole time.
So you didn't.
Mm-hmm.
Now you make mention of the fact that you're around a bunch of men. Who build up, it's a male kind of culture, mm-hmm. It's a male society. You were a feminist going in.
Yeah.
What was this like? Suddenly, you know, okay, you own me, I'm yours, I'm your property, I'll do whatever you say. Isn't there a rule that you cannot object to a teaching?
Well, that wasn't explicit. It's more implicit in it. And I'm not sure with the monks what their rules are. But I knew it was a very paternalistic culture. I mean, in Burma, not just in Buddhism in general, but in Burma, it's sort of like you don't make a decision unless you ask your father or your brother or the head of the village or the abbot of the monastery. And here I was, as you say, a feminist and a pretty aware woman making a choice to be in that sort of situation. And it was hard for me. I knew I was getting into it, and I said, again, maybe this is something I can put aside for the time being. But actually what happened after a while was it really started to bother me. It was I couldn't even go outside the monastery gates at all. We were so protected in there.
Well, that's kind of interesting. So that must be the beauty of it as well then. At the beginning, you walk in and you're learning to give up all of these mindsets you have. You surrender.
Exactly.
You surrender. And that must be the path to finding at least part of what you're looking for, isn't it?
Well, it's definitely this kind of path. I mean, you're not doing it because you're a masochist, and you're not doing it because, you know, you hate sexuality, or at least I should say I'm not doing it for these reasons. I was doing it because I was there to learn this technique, and I knew that this teacher is a master, and I wanted to study with him, and I wanted to practice, and I wanted to have an unended period of practice. And you can go there to these monasteries, and they don't cost anything because they want to support the practice of mindfulness, which probably you've talked about before on the show, but the practice of really just being awake in each moment. And it's almost like going in there like a boot camp. They say to you, be mindful in every moment, which means from the moment you wake up until the moment you go to sleep, and they encourage you only to sleep, say, 4 hours a night, but you're practicing mindfulness, awareness of the moment, even when you're going to the toilet, when you're brushing your teeth, when you're eating, and when you're sitting on a cushion.
Mindfulness,
yeah.
What am I? Where am I? What's going on now? Being in the present, mindfulness.
Exactly.
Not being in the past, not being in the future. Not being nervous, just saying, I am what I am, I accept what I am, and I am this and what I don't see as well.
Yes, and it's not necessarily so conceptual. I mean, mm-hmm. It's a lot of it is sort of what's happening with your breath, feeling the sensations of your breath, the rising and falling of your abdomen, noticing a thought coming, letting it go, noticing an emotion, being present with the emotion, letting the emotion go. It's not so much inquiry into it as just experiencing it.
And this is what you teach now.
This is what I teach, yeah.
This is what you spend your days doing, teaching mindfulness in this way.
Well, it's something I do sort of part-time.
Okay, yeah. We're going to get back to the adventure of it, but, you know, you teach teenagers as well?
Yes.
How do they respond? I mean, what happens with teenagers?
I do work with some kids from all sorts of backgrounds. There's one project we do in California working with incarcerated teens and teens mm-hmm. at risk. How do they respond? You know, it's very interesting because it depends what angle we come at it with.
Sure.
I mean, we could come at it with the angle like, you must wake up and something is wrong with you if you don't. But instead it's like, do you want your life to be more alive? Like, if you're mindful, you're really here. You're really experiencing what's going on. And you can be better at playing pool or video games if you're awake. And so it's a very different twist on it than sort of classical teachings that might happen in a Burmese monastery.
Interesting. My guest, Diana Winston, Buddhist, teaching us a little about Buddhism. Who, by the way, if you remember, we had Nicholas Vreeland, right? So if you married Nicholas, you'd become Diana Vreeland. No, we can't do it that way then.
And he can't marry because he's a monk.
Because he's a monk. Well, you never know. Let's talk a little about these guys. I think that the Buddhist way, the 226 rules for Buddhism on the way that you're allowed to be, I think they're precious. I think they're terrific if you could do it. I think it teaches you a lot about yourself. I think it helps you step away from a lot of your attachments. I think if everybody had a chance to practice Buddhism for a period of time and then incorporate that in their life, you can't go wrong. Unless you're somebody who spaces out normally and you have a hard time landing your feet on the ground in any way, then I think sometimes you're going in the wrong direction. But for a person who really wants to make their life somewhat rounded so that they can incorporate a lot of the stuff into the present day to be more present, I think learning Buddhism is a wonderful thing to do. But now, the monks, right? The monks have a number of different rules that they can and cannot do. And I remember once Nicholas Vreeland being in the studio. I think it was Paula Jack brought him a sandwich or something like that, and I think you touched his arm in passing. And I saw a, I thought he was going to take out a whip and flog himself. What's the story there?
Well, okay, these rules, they're very strict rules about the way that monks relate to women. Basically, we're completely segregated in the monastery. It's very, very confused, and the men sort of see women as a potential, a humongous pitfall, essentially. Like, so they're not allowed to be touched or to touch a woman, and if they do, it's considered a very grave infraction. And they're not, I mean, if they have sex with a woman, this breaks this means they can no longer be a monk. I mean, they're out of the order.
They get demonkified.
Demonkified, yes.
Right, derobed, what's it called?
What is it called? I'm not sure.
Okay. Okay, so the worst that could happen is if you have sex with a woman, right? What if you have sex with a man?
Also, you can't do. It's probably because there's a lot of heterosexism within these cultures, it's probably considered less grave than if you have sex with a woman.
Okay, so there's no sex with a woman, and now you say severe and not severe, and this runs us into this question of the hell realms. You know, how severe is severe? What happens to you if you make a severe sin outside of being banished, right, from the orders in some kind of way? I guess they put you on a list or something. What happens? You lose your robe. You can't be a monk.
Right.
According to who? I mean, what if you walk around just wearing monk robes anyway?
Well, that's considered even worse. I mean, to be
a fake monk.
To be a fake monk, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's really bad. If you're excommunicated, essentially, that's it. You can't come back into the monastery.
But you're also damned to hell, aren't you?
Well,
and what is? Tell me about hell. Tell me about hell in Buddhism.
Yeah.
I mean, do you get along with that really well? This whole idea of hell and the punishments and.
Not really. You know, it's hard for a Westerner to understand this. And when I was there, I had been practicing Buddhism in a Western context, primarily through Insight Meditation Society and the Vipassana community in America. And when we talk about hells, we don't take it so literally. I mean, we explain that there's these cultural beliefs in the hells. And in canonical Buddhism, there are these hells. There's the burning hell and the freezing hell. And if you do a certain kind of deed, you'll end up in a hell where you're kind of smushed in with everybody. They call it the hell with no room. And it's very graphic.
Could you give me a little more? I mean, you know, you're so familiar with these. What are the different hells? The hell with no room is like living in Manhattan.
Probably. But actually, I think it's supposed to be you're burning up and it's like millions of people jammed into this tiny, tiny space and you're right up against someone and you're being tortured or something. I mean, these hell realms are so graphically described in.
So the belief is that if you could commit certain sins. Are they called sins?
Yes.
Okay, you commit certain sins, and if you commit these sins, things will happen to you. Like if you murder someone, you could go to the hell realms, and in the hell realms, you're going to be burning forever, like in Catholicism.
No,
is that the way
this
it works?
Is the difference in Buddhism. The difference is it's not permanent. So any time that if you commit an action and you end up, and you have to keep this in mind, this is all sort of cultural beliefs. It's not necessarily what I believe. But and you end up in the hell, hopefully some good actions that you've created, your good karma and the results of your good karma or actions will ripen at some point, and you'll get sent out of the hell into another realm. I mean, the Buddhists have a vast cosmology, which includes God realms and heaven realms and animal realms and earth. I think, 27 different realms of existence.
So if you do something that's a real sin, mm-hmm. you can wind up in a real torturous kind of place, and then through redemption and through accumulation of deeds that you've done, the other stuff somehow it kind of washes you out, and you could get out of that and you could ascend. You could kind of move out of it over time.
Yeah, this is what they believe.
Okay, this is what they believe. And if we believe in reincarnation, we may believe that you come back to a difficult life, and the fact that you came back to a difficult life could be considered a hell realm in its own.
That's right. I mean, you can look at this in all sorts of terms. And the way that I prefer is looking at it sort of more psychologically. Like, we go into the hell realms and out of the hell realms constantly in our daily life.
Absolutely.
And some might say that living in a really tiny cramped apartment in New York City can be a kind of hell realm in the summer, in the heat. Or my own anger. When I'm really caught in tremendous anger, I'm in a kind of hell. And when I'm experiencing joy and bliss, it's a God realm, it's a heaven realm. And so we kind of fall in and out of these realms. And actually the point in the practice is to have a mind that can be present through all the heaven and hell realms that we're psychologically moving through. And this is a term we use a lot, equanimity, sort of a peacefulness of mind in this.
Hmm. Diana Winston, Armand DeMille. We're talking about Buddhism, but we're not only talking about Buddhism, we're talking about this path. All right, so why are there 226 rules for monkdom, this is, by the way?
Right, this is what monks adopt. The rules were developed, they kind of have an interesting history, because if you look back, the Buddha encouraged people to become homeless wanderers, and originally there were no rules at all. But more and more people did it, and because these people, even though it was, 500 BC or so, these people were very similar to us. I mean, they had a lot of greed and hatred and confusion and ignorance, and so they wanted to do things because they didn't want to be, they didn't necessarily want to be meditating or practicing. So we had to develop rules like no stealing and no killing and no sex. And then what happened was the rules became more and more elaborate over time, because once one rule was set down, then a monk would figure out how to subvert it. And so then they'd have to make a rule about that. It's sort of like the way the legal system developed here. Yeah.
So, for example, they had to make a rule, no having sex with dead bodies is an actually stated rule of Buddhism. Is that true?
Yeah, a rule in what's called the Vinaya, or the rules for the monks. It's not like a general
rule for the monk
in Buddhism.
Right, but no sex with dead bodies.
Well, you have to assume, I guess, that some monk tried to do that because he heard he wasn't allowed to have a sex with a woman. And so he thought, what about a dead woman? So I don't know. This rule developed in that way.
I wonder if our Congress is going to make new rules about cigars and things. I mean, what's going to happen? Of course, you just make a whole rule just out of one guy breaking the rule in
some
way.
That's right.
Well, I guess, it's got to be had, because a lot of the passions really do drive us in such a way that the people are going to try to find some way to let the water leak out of the jar, no matter how waterproof you're trying to make it. So let's say you're not allowed to steal, but greed and avarice and all of the other feelings that are there are going to manifest one way or another. Somebody's going to want to be the best Buddhist. Somebody's going to want to be the head Buddhist. Somebody's going to want to become the associate director. Another person's going to want to wear the best robes, and the nicest robes. So somehow it doesn't mean that once you go in there, you don't have all that neurosis from childhood that brought you there maybe in the first place, So that stuff is going to manifest, and there are a number of infractions. Who judges the infractions? Is there a court? Is there a rule, a body, a bunch of people?
There is kind of a monk's court. It's actually, I found it sort of amusing, although I was out of this because I was a nun. I just know from my friends who practiced as monks. If you commit something, a really minor offense, then you could just tell a fellow monk, and that's considered a kind of confessional, and then you're absolved. However, if you do something really major, you have to sit in front of a board of 20 monks, all of whom are very senior to you, who, if you're a Westerner, don't understand a Western mind and why we would do this, right? And they have to hear it and judge you. It's very similar to religions in our country.
Because it's such interesting stuff. And we'll be back with you in just a couple of minutes.
L'air se cabre dans la nuit d'hiver. Tout est silence, terre et ciel. Le désert, lui, loin de la mer. Tout en bas du mont Saint-Michel. Au sommet, j'avale un vent muet, grisant comme un vin de Toscane. Mon regard.
So we're talking here about turning your life over to a dedication. We're talking with Diana Winston, and we're talking about life as a Buddhist nun and what happens before, middle, and after, and talked about why she was in this thing and what it was like being in it, being in the middle of having your head shaved, laying down. Now, Diana, while I've got you, I just skipped over one juicy point. You're pretty, you know.
Thank you.
No, I didn't mean it. Well, I do mean that, too. You're pretty, okay? But besides that, you're from this area where you don't have problems, and, you know, pretty, you've slept in nice beds, and you wore nice clothing. Now, what about the cockroaches? I mean, you get there in Burma, and one thing I know about Burma is if you decided to have a high-protein meal, it's around you every minute.
You're referring to
bugs and snakes and
the friends in my house that I was living.
Now you took a rule that said you shall not hurt a sentient being.
That's right.
What does sentient mean?
Sentient means one with a mind.
Nobody with a mind. So you assume that flies have minds?
That's what we assume. Yes.
Okay. Everything has a mind.
Uh huh.
But vegetables don't have minds, right?
The line is drawn around vegetables, trees, and so forth, although it's debatable. But
some of my best friends are tomatoes. Okay, but you just can't, around fruits, vegetables, no, but living things.
Right.
So here's the living thing. You're laying on a mat. You come from Connecticut. You have been, I like this. I do this a lot with Connecticut. So you're laying on this mat. You're wearing a lot of robes because you don't want anybody to see any part of your body because, you know, a monk may get out of control and come smashing through or something, or you may tempt him. And you're laying there with snakes. How do you deal with all this? How did you really deal with it? I mean, yeah. What did you feel? Did you eek?
It was actually pretty horrifying in the beginning. I was astounded. I mean, I thought I wasn't that squeamish, but I got there and there were more species of crawling things than anything I've ever seen in my life. They had spiders the size of my hand. They had centipedes that were poisonous if you stepped on it. You wouldn't die, but you'd get quite sick. They had these giant scorpions. I mean, giant, you know, I've seen little scorpions, but these were about the length of my arm. I mean, they were humongous.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, it was really scary. And snakes, like you wouldn't believe. And Then the little ones, I mean, these were like the poisonous ones, but then there were sort of the mild, scary ones that were living in the room with me. And the mosquitoes. The mosquitoes actually were some of the worst of it. And the ants. And then all sorts of ones I can't even identify. I'm sure we don't have in America.
So what did you do? I mean, you can't eat them.
No, you didn't eat them. What I did was I learned to work with it. You know, I learned to work with my fear around bugs. And I had to learn to catch them in my hand and get them out, for instance, mosquitoes, and get it out of the room. The Burmese people, for some reason, like to build these houses with lots of holes in them. So I was living in a little hut in the woods with ceiling holes, which would allow all sorts of spiders and bugs to come through.
So they'd come visit you.
Yes.
And they'd see that you were a Buddhist and they'd leave you alone.
No.
I mean, any chance that you could get attacked? I mean, any chance? Does anybody get hurt? Were you there? Did any of the other Buddhist nuns ever get
eaten? A centipede crawled on one monk's face and tried to bite him, but he brushed it off. But other than that, I mean, they want to have a life too. And so they like, usually, especially when it gets, when the water supply goes down, they come into the houses. And it was
looking for maybe whatever water they can get from your body.
Something like that.
nice image laying there with little centipedes and scorpions crawling around.
I mean, we had mosquito nets, so I slept in a mosquito net. And when I would do sitting meditation, I'd sit on a cushion with the big mosquito net coming down surrounding me. But they would get in sometimes, and then it would become a torture chamber instead.
What'd you do when you had to go to the bathroom? is it in the net? I mean, do you make sure you don't leave the net?
You get out and you sort of like walk, but you're supposed to be mindful and you're supposed to be slow. So
oh
I'm slowly
gosh.
Trying. And then if it's dark, I'm praying that I don't step on something. I mean, it wasn't, I'm slight exaggeration. It wasn't all the time, always. But I would go into the bathroom. We had a little bathroom attached to our room.
There must have been some pretty things in there, too.
Oh, yeah. That's where the spiders lived. But I learned to love the spiders.
In the toilet.
No, they would live sort of above me. The spiders ate the mosquitoes. So
you get friends with them.
Yeah, and the fact is...
But then they couldn't be Buddhists because they were eating mosquitoes and they're not supposed to do that, right?
That's a good point.
Never thought about that. You're getting friends with non-Buddhists.
Exactly.
All right, so I understand.
Some of my best friends are non-Buddhists.
I'm making a joke about it, but it really kind of horrendous. And it does teach you there is so much that frightens us that we shouldn't be afraid of. There is so much of us. I've had the experience of studying in countries where stuff that would have scared the hell out of me normally, you know, just really brought me to myself. I said, I'm here. I'm here to learn. I'm sleeping on this mat. You know, I'm going to be on this floor for weeks at a time, and this is the way it is.
It's a really good point. I mean, I learned to work with fear. And that was one of the most profound things, being there, was seeing how incredibly scared I was of spiders and snakes and so on, and learning that it's a mental state. It arises in the body, in the mind. You feel it, and you can be with it. And generally, they don't attack you, and you learn to move through it. I mean, that was very exciting and very liberating. It happened similarly with illness, because I was sick quite a lot. The food was fairly unsanitary, and I was often had some kind of stomach problem going, and I realized I would create all these stories in my head about, oh no, I have giardia, I have some parasites, I have, you know, all the things that the mind would do around this horrible supposed illness. And usually, if I just waited, it would go away. And so I learned to work with my own internal hypochondria and to not be so scared when I was sick. So a lot of it was dealing with anxiety and dealing with fear. It was quite profound.
So there was the absence of sexuality, right? Kind of threw that out. You're not going to be sexual. You're not going to be attractive. Diana, between you, me, and the millions of people listening, did you wake up and say, how do I look? I mean, did you brush down your wrinkles, or did you actually give up how I look?
I didn't.
Did you care about your appearance at all?
It's interesting. I didn't look in a mirror except when I had to shave my head. So that was once every 4 days. And when you don't have a mirror, that becomes so much less interesting. There's nothing to kind of provoke you in a way.
Huh. Interesting. We live with the image of ourselves, and we live trying to become this image of ourselves. When you don't have an image, right, or an image production, you kind of get a chance to find out what you really are. No self-consciousness? What about body smells?
Well, I was so sort of secluded from people. I was practicing in a little hut in the woods, and I'd only see people at meals and when we'd have to go hear the teacher speak and when I'd have interviews with the teacher. So I wasn't terribly concerned with that kind of stuff.
Oh, so you weren't studying with a bunch of people. You weren't meditating with a bunch of people. You were in a room alone?
Most of the time, although there was a group of people that came and went over the course of time that I was there.
So all of that, including giving up, there is a kind of a basic fundamentalism to it, isn't there?
You mean within the religion in Burma?
Yeah.
Well, there's certainly, they're very literal. For instance, when we were talking about the hell realms, they take the hell realms very literally. Whereas as Westerners, we might not. And so, or they take the teachings very literally. And that was very difficult for me because I wasn't sure I believed all of that. I believed in the power of the meditation practice because I was sitting 14, 15 hours a day and seeing results in my life. I was seeing that I was getting to know my mind and my body much more profoundly than I ever had in my life. But when they would go into a lot of the, you know, the cultural things about the hell realms or, you know, this makes merit and in this life, if you do this, you'll have such and such a result. That was a lot less interesting to me than my direct experience.
We're talking with Diana Winston. This is Armand DeMille, Positive Mind, here on WBAI. We're talking about somebody who took a journey. And this journey led to a place where, according to everyone I know who knows you, you're a major contributor to this world in the way you bring people to their own insides. I've read a little bit of your work, too, Diana. You know, I've enjoyed your writing, and I hope your book gets around real soon. I'm dying to see more of it. You're still working on that, right?
I've been working on a book about my time in Burma, and it's some ways it's to process what happened during that course of that year and also to share with people because it was such an peculiar and wonderful and hard experience.
I saw a picture of two Buddhist monks with their leg hanging over a chair, smoking cigarettes, watching television. And I was kind of surprised, right? Now,
yes.
Now, this is something that you can't easily see in Burma, right?
You don't see it so much in Burma. You see it, I didn't, but I know it's happening for sure. And it's happening quite a bit in Thailand as well.
Because Buddhists can smoke.
Well, this is sort of a point of law, perhaps. The rules were set down thousands of years ago, and at the time there were no cigarettes and there was no television, so there was no prescription against no cigarettes or no television. Now, you could read one of the rules into that. For instance, there's a rule against entertainment. But if people are being quite literal, they might say, oh, but it doesn't say no TV.
But it's against euphorics and... We don't consider cigarettes to be a euphoric because they were reading the commercials that Philip Morris put out. You know, there's no drugs in here.
That's right. There's no drugs.
Right. There's no drugs. We're just smoking
exactly
nature's weeds.
Exactly. But the point around the rules, like we were talking about earlier, I mean, people will do – you set down a rule and people will do whatever they can to kind of avoid it and get around it, right? But if you pay attention to the spirit of the rules, that's where the freedom is. I mean, it's like working, like we were talking about working with fear. You work with the difficulty of having discipline, and you notice what happens in your mind and your body, and you can go beyond that, and you can find freedom within it.
And that's the beauty of it.
Absolutely.
That's the beauty of it. You go into something so oppressive that you challenge yourself all over the place. You get the chance to challenge yourself. It takes a lot of courage. Takes a lot of courage to have a dedication, you know, where you say, I'm going to go this, I'm going to do it that, I'm going to do it their way. Somebody wants to make a way, let's do it their way. It would be interesting to go over the 226 rules to see if there are any that were, you know, 2,000 years ago had sense that no longer even apply nowadays. Like, you know, we have rules in our country, you know, there are rules, state rules against certain sexual practices that no longer really apply, like, you know, you can't have sex with trees or something like that. They must have stuff like that in the Buddhist rules. Do you know of any?
Certainly.
Really archaic ones, like, you know, you can't hug a carrot or something?
It's hard to remember exactly, but there's certainly all sorts of ones in relation to things that no longer exist. There's a lot around travel and the ways that they traveled back then in carts and with horses and what you can do with horses and this. And, you know, it's irrelevant in relation to our car.
So there are no rules about cars.
Right, of course, because
you can have any kind of car you want, and you can have a you know, a UV or whatever it is that you get nowadays. I understand. Okay, that makes sense, but that's like most of life, you know? Most of society is the same things. There used to be a rule about don't put your hat on the bed from Europe. And I remember, never put your hat on the bed. It was based on the fact that people had lice. And that to put your hat on the bed meant that you would be bringing lice. And they made it sinful if you put your hat on the bed. So that people would remember, don't put your hat on the bed. Okay, Diana, so you leave the monastery. You leave Burma. You say, I've had enough. Now, I remember you were there around the time of a lot of political strife. I mean, there were bombs going off to your right and left, weren't there?
Well, it's funny about Burma. There's always political strife going on in Burma. When I was there, it was the summer of, let's see, 98, and that was when there was Aung San Suu Kyi has been, as I said, under house arrest, and she's the leader of the democracy movement. She was locked in a car and was detained, and that made national news in quite a big way. Also, at the time, there were several Westerners that went into the country and leafleted downtown Rangoon, the capital of Burma, and saying we haven't forgotten you, essentially, because Burma, nobody really knows about Burma. It's another Tibet. It's a situation that there's such oppressiveness, and there are no human rights in this country. And so so this was a solidarity action. I was there during that time, and it got, again, big news, which, of course, sent a lot of fear into people that knew me.
Mom called you up and said, what are you doing, honey? Come home.
Exactly. Right. Exactly.
Okay, but then besides that, you left for your own reasons.
I did.
Why'd you leave?
Well, there are a lot of reasons. In some ways, I felt like I was finished. I had gone to learn. I had gone on a sort of a search for enlightenment. That was a big piece of it. I thought that Burma would be the place that I could get enlightened. And I don't even know where that idea came from. Except that they kind of sell it. When you go there, they say, oh, welcome, welcome, may you soon get enlightened. Because they hold it as such a high value in the culture, which is wonderful. But at the same time, for Westerners, myself included, it can become a very, very ambitious way of approaching enlightenment, as though enlightenment were something to get. If you do this meditation practice, and maybe if you ordain as a Buddhist monk or nun, and if you work really hard, you can get enlightenment. But what is getting enlightenment? And that, I think, was what I needed to learn. And it was only through the hardships of being there extensively for such a period of time and really trying to get something that is unknowable, that is ungraspable, that is not even anywhere outside of us here. That's just conceptual. Once I realized that, and it took me a long period of time, I realized, wow, you know, I can at this point go back into the West. And I also felt very strongly that I'd been sitting in a monastery for a year, and I'm a very political person. And the whole time I was wondering, well, I'm not doing anything, making any effect in the world, which may or may not be true. And I really felt like I needed to see what happened when I left. If what I did sitting on the cushion for that whole year didn't have effect on the planet when I got out, then what good was it?
What'd you find out?
What did I find out? It's a hard question. There's been a lot of shifts in me since that time, and I don't know what really happened. I think I'm still unpacking it. I've only been back in the States for a year now. I think that if the thing I learned the most, or maybe two things I learned the most, I'm a lot gentler on myself. I don't need to push myself so much to come to some kind of, I don't know, ideal about how I think I should be or who I am. I feel softer and kinder. And I trust myself a lot more.
You came back, you came out, you grew your hair again.
That's right.
Right? You went and got some clothing, right? You must have had to come back to being part of the sexual world. What was that like?
Well,
I mean, you're gone for all that period of time,
yes.
Right? Right. That's it. You shut it off, right?
Yeah, and I think being a nun, I learned a lot about my sexuality in a way, because I got to see how much I was devoting this energy to sexuality, and then coming out, I felt some sort of spaciousness around it. Like I don't necessarily have to jump into relationships, and sexuality isn't necessarily something that's going to make me happy. It may provide happiness, but it's not like my happiness is dependent upon being in a partnership or having a sexual relationship. And I think the freedom that came from celibacy, from chosen celibacy for that year, really opened that up for me.
So what happened when you got back in a relationship?
Well, I was very, let's see, I have to think about this. I was very, I'm much more kind of careful, I think. Careful about my actions and about my words and about what being in relationship is about. And I'm not in relationship at the moment, and learning to be with that is fine too. It's an interesting process.
But you could be a teacher of Buddhism and still have relationships at this point.
Of course.
Right?
Sure.
So it's really but Nicholas is a monk.
Right. I'm not a nun anymore. And so I can go back into the sexual world. I'm a nun.
A non-nun.
Right.
And you could go back anytime you want. You could go back into it. Can you go back into it if you want?
Oh, absolutely.
You just put the robes on and say, I'm a nun again, and you're a nun?
Well, yeah. I mean, I don't think I would do it within that tradition anymore. I don't feel so compelled by this particular style and this particular teacher. So I probably would not do that. But I might choose at some point. It's just, these are questions that I have, and they're unresolved questions of whether the monastic life is appropriate for Westerners as sort of a long-term commitment. And it's something I really think about because for a short term it was wonderful, but most of my friends, and I have several friends, for instance, who've chosen to be monks for life in the West, and most of them have disrobed, have stopped being a monk or nun. And it's because we don't have a structure here that's set up for that. People think it's so strange that someone would do that. They walk down the street and they wonder, you know, who is this odd person with a shaved head wearing a dress, right? And so the structures don't exist and people can't maintain it, whereas in the Asian cultures where it's considered wonderful to be a monk or nun. I mean, can you imagine, like, the person who is the most loved in their culture is the person who has the freest mind. Like, the most enlightened being is the most loved. Whereas here, who's the one we love the most? I don't know, celebrities, you know, rock stars, whatever. That's who the culture idealizes. So it's a very different thing to be a monastic in the West versus the East.
Well, I thank you for being with us, Diana Winston. We've learned a great deal. I mean, I've learned a great deal. I thought you know what I like the most, Diana? What I like is how honest you are. Mm. And there's something about the honesty of it. The other day we had a therapist on the air who said she was singing as a hobby. And I had her say, and as I said, so sing me a song. And she sang a wonderful song out loud on the air. And everybody said, you know how honest that person is. The beauty of it is, what I see about you that I find is so good, is that you have a good sound psychological background that leads you to this place where you really just want to live an honest life. Because what is a dedication to honesty if you're truly avoiding yourself? You know, truly avoiding it. And I've run into too many people who do spiritual practices who are avoiding themselves right and left. They don't lie to anybody, but they lie to themselves.
Your mind is a beautiful piece of engineering. It's been said that if you do what you've always done, you're going to get what you always got. Here's a chance to learn new ways to be with people and to be with yourself as well. Tune into The Positive Mind, Tuesdays and Wednesdays at 1 p.m. on WBAI 99.5 FM. It's knowledge from the heart, my friends.
We're going to have to be going right now, my friends. If you wanted to hear today's program again, you could go to WBAI.org, or you can go to thepositivemind.com, where you'll hear a lot of archives. And you could send an email also to Armand, A-R-M-A-N-D, at thepositivemind.com. I'd love to hear from you and hear your reaction. Be back with you soon, my friends. Constant elevation till I'm fully blown. I'm on my own now, in my own world, feeling free. Can't change the way I am with your insanity. I'ma stay who I be, can't nobody change me. Got my soul to protect and support my family.
Die alone, but we don't shovel on. We eat me and Emma West. Blaze the chair and we ride and ride and ride.